Welcome to the Barr Smith Library at the University of Adelaide. My name is Ray Choate. I'm the university librarian here, and it does give me great pleasure to welcome you here this evening. My first thing I have to remind you is if you have one of these things in your wallet or purse or pocket, called a mobile phone or a cell phone, whatever you want to call them, please turn it off as a courtesy to our speaker. The second thing is I apologize for the AV equipment in this room. One of my predecessors as university librarian, Ira Raymond, when he and his wife passed away, they left the library a nice legacy to upgrade the Ira Raymond room. So I'm hoping by next year we will have state-of-the-art AV equipment and we won't have to put up with what we put up with the present time. I won't carry on much further, but I'd like to ask a fellow member of the Friends of the Library Committee, Mary Norden, who will introduce our speaker tonight. Mary.
I'm delighted to have the job of introducing Jane Brummett tonight. I think she has done a remarkable job. This is a really extraordinary book. I mean, I thought of Mae Gibbs just as a very successful children's writer. I cringed occasionally at Snugglepop and the other lovely Gummed-Up Baby. But I've now discovered, of course, through Jane's wonderful book, that there was a great deal more to Mae Gibbs than I ever thought about. And this started, apparently, as a volunteer project at the state library, is that right? And now, of course, it's developed into something very much bigger, which is historical and political and literary. And I do congratulate Jane on that. I'll tell you a few details about her. Her career began as a junior primary teacher and librarian. She's worked in country Australia, Adelaide, Edinburgh, and Sydney. She is married with a supportive family, and recently, I suppose it's not really recently, the 1990s, she gained an arts degree at this university. She regards her support as a successful battle to save Nutcote, of which, of course, you're aware, Mae Gibbs' home in Sydney, as one of the most worthwhile things that she has done. And so I'll hand over to Jane and thank her for coming.
Thank you very much, Mary. I'm always delighted when people say they've heard a few new things about Mae Gibbs that they didn't know. And thank you all for coming, for your interest, coming out on such a cold day. And I'm very thrilled to be here. It's a great compliment to Mae Gibbs. Mae Gibbs has intrigued me for as long as I can remember, and stories about her have punctuated my life. Her brother Ivan married my father's sister, Josephine Porter. The families lived next door in South Perth. When I was growing up in Netherby in the 1940s and 50s, my uncle and aunt went to visit May at Nutcote. And en route, they called in at Adelaide. And I remember having dinner on the ship and hanging on every word about the genius, because that's what the family called her. In May 1954, at my request, Josephine and Ivan brought me back from Nutcote an autographed copy of Prince Dandelion, May's last book, for my 16th birthday. Another girl in my class at school got a car, but I was... I hope mine's worth more, but I've given it to Nutcote. And I was actually quite disappointed at the time that it wasn't about Gumnut Town. In 1956, I went to Perth to stay with my aunt and uncle, and I realised then that May had created far more than Gumnut Town. When I saw her award-winning botanical works, portraits and caricatures from long before she created Gumnut Town, but they influenced what she did. May's books inspired my love of the bush. After I married Bob, this led to my creating our native garden, or starting it. In 1991, at the State Library, the late Juliana Bayfield, later Archbold, librarian for the Children's Literature Research Collection, supported the Nutcote campaign by curating an exhibition. Juliana initiated research on May's satirical and political cartoons in newspapers. She was very interested to find that I recognised Gibbs family members in May's satirical works. Some of these newspaper works were included in the exhibition and created so much interest that this inspired exhibitions interstate and at the first open weekend held in Nutcote in 1994. In 1998, as a State Library volunteer, Juliana invited me to expand the unfinished research, which she had started on May Gibbs' works in newspapers. In a nutshell, Juliana's original initiative led eventually to this book, co-authored with art historian Robert Holden. And last October, it was launched at Nutcote by Professor Marie Bashir, the Governor of New South Wales. And I've brought some of the examples that Juliana used at the State Library in case you'd like to have a look at them later. In notes for an autobiography, which she never completed, May described her life as a fairy tale. She was born in Kent in 1877. Her version is that she was delivered by Dr. Stork and resembled her mother by looking like a frog. Her parents, Herbert and Cecy Gibbs, were a cultured couple who had met at the Slade School of Art in the first year in which it admitted women. Intent on farming life, Herbert Gibbs decided to emigrate with his family and brother George to Franklin Harbour, present-day Cowell, where land was cheap in 1881. At the last minute, May developed the measles, so only her father and uncle went ahead. On arrival, the brothers were disillusioned, but back in England with her children Bertie 5 and May 4, Cecy Gibbs knew none of this. She was pregnant, and May writes of her mother saying, "I can't wait for them to tell me what it's like. I'm going." She gave birth to Ivan on board the Hesperus. All his life, my Uncle Ivan joked about himself as the wreck of the Hesperus. Farming at Cowell proved a failure. The Gibbs family moved to Norwood, and then to the village of Knightsbridge, now Leabrook, two streets away from where we live. And I only found that out a couple of years ago, and I'm thrilled to bits to know it. Herbert and George Gibbs headed for Harvey, Western Australia, early in 1885. In May, the pregnant Cecy and her three children, aged 10, 8 and 3, followed. Cecy gave birth to a stillborn baby shortly afterwards, and the baby was buried in a grave by the Harvey River. Happiness followed when George Gibbs married Ellen Holden from Adelaide's family of Holden cow fame. May loved the bushland of Harvey and described her life's two happiest years as being there. The children swam in a pool now known as the Gibbs Pool, which she immortalised in Snugglepot and Cuddle Pie. Instead of children diving, she drew frogs diving with gumnut babies on their backs. Harvey was a place to which May often returned to visit her Uncle George's family, and her young cousins loved to listen to the stories she made up, inspired by that setting. The big bad Banksia men have their origin there too, and that's in the book. Herbert's second attempt at farming failed, and again the family moved to a cottage on 10 acres at Butler's Swamp, halfway between Perth and Fremantle and now called Lake Claremont. For the third time in her life, Ceci moved house while pregnant. And here she is with her baby, baby Harold, who was 10 years younger than May. At Butler's Swamp, Herbert embarked on his career as an artist. Through meeting Henry Prinsep, he became cartoonist for a new comic and satirical paper called The Possum. Prinsep was a draftsman in Perth's land office and a leader in the artistic, literary and theatrical life of Perth. He taught drawing in his studio, which doubled as a dance hall for parties. The families became great friends. The Possum's introductory squeak expounded its intention to shoot the public and hit them on their funny bones. West Australia was still a crown colony, controlled in most respects from London. Herbert Gibbs's first cartoon for the Possum showed young Western Australia pleading with Queen Victoria to let him paddle his own canoe. Through her cartoonist father, young May observed the political agitation which resulted in responsible government for the colony in 1890. May remembered Butler's Swamp for its frogs, and frogs later featured in her work as rescuers of gumnut babies, from evil Banksia men, as musicians in the Gum Blossom Ballet, and as oarsmen in Currajong pods. With Herbert now working and teaching as an artist, May's family moved again to central Perth, their house backed on to the home of the future Premier John Forrest, whose wife Margaret painted wildflowers in her studio. As well as continuing his cartoon work, Herbert taught art, and May went to Miss Best's school for one term. In 1889, May saw the first art exhibition ever held in Western Australia of wildflowers, of West Australian wildflowers, painted by the renowned Melbourne flower painter Ellis Rowan and by Margaret Forrest. Soon after this, Western Australia's first Society of Artists was formed. Its initiator was Margaret Forrest, and it was named the Wilgie Sketching Club, after a local Aboriginal word for the coloured clay with which Aborigines painted themselves before a corroboree. The family then moved again to a home they named the Dune in South Perth, and their moving stopped there. May was 12, and she had this Christmas page published especially for children in the WA Bulletin. You can see the South Perth Mill in the far left corner. The WA Bulletin was the paper for which May's father had created his political cartoons and which had originally been called The Possum. Its name change reflected the success of Sydney's Bulletin. In old age, May wrote of this era, father cartoonist to Perth's first comic paper, heartbreaking work. Herbert was West Australia's first cartoonist. Little Folks shows May's beginnings as a cartoonist, modelling herself on her father. She became Australia's first woman cartoonist to earn a living from her work. Like his friend Henry Prinsep, Herbert now started earning a reliable income as a draftsman in the public service, with art as a prolific hobby. In June 1890, the Wilgie Club held its only exhibition, and Herbert, Ceci and May all exhibited. West Australia boomed in the 1890s, largely thanks to wealth from its gold discoveries, unlike the rest of depressed Australia. May Gibbs could not have spent these years in a better place. Homeschooled, she was steeped in books, art and music. From her father's studio at the Dune, May's output in black and white, watercolour and oils was prolific and ranged widely. She lived in a stimulating household, full of music, sketching, cartooning, picnics, boating and fun. The next one is May's first earliest newspaper work. It was created in 1897 when she was 20, but was not published for 10 more years. Her parents' milieu was a stimulating group of cultured and artistic Perth people, amongst whom May regarded her father as her best teacher. The Wilgie Club wound up in 1896 when 50 gentlemen interested in art met to form a West Australian Society of Arts. May's father, Herbert, chaired the meeting. And following objections, which were outvoted, the society admitted women on equal terms with men. I haven't been able to find any record of Herbert Gibbs being part of the South Australian Society of Arts during his 4 years here, though it was certainly a going concern. These orchids are just one example of May's ability to paint wildflowers. It was also created in 1897 when she was 20. And that year she was invited to illuminate an address to Queen Victoria from the women of Western Australia to celebrate the Queen's Diamond Jubilee. May depicted West Australian wildflowers and animals in her design, and the tribute was presented to the Queen by the Premier, Sir John Forrest, and his artist wife, Margaret. The Queen was evidently pleased, so the newspaper said. She's unlikely to have known that 10 years earlier, in support of self-government for her colony, the artist's father had cartooned her in the possum. I've seen a photograph of the address, and how I wish we could get it back from wherever it is royally stored and exhibited. For the Paris exhibition in 1900, May's works headed the wildflower contributors from Western Australia. Again, how I wish we could see her contributions along with her other beautiful wildflower works. They deserve a retrospective exhibition, along with her portraits, landscapes, and many newspaper works. And I know of family members who are keen to lend original works. May was also musically talented. As well as singing well, she played both the piano and the violin. She also revelled in performing, and her love of music was fostered by her musically talented mother, whose initiative in the operatic society was very helpful, and Ceci was a leading light. The whole family performed Gilbert and Sullivan, and when the orchestra needed a viola, Herbert Gibbs made one and played it. May was fortunate to be taught by gifted musicians who lived in that colony. By 1900, Ceci Gibbs had inherited money as a ward in Chancery, and she decided to invest it in her daughter's career. Together, they sailed to England so that May could go to art school as her parents had. Back in Perth in 1902, May was published in newspapers, but incognito. She used the self-deprecating name Blob. Success with her black and white work at the Society of Arts exhibition had led to her first newspaper commission to create political cartoons for the cover of the Social Kodak, the first women's paper published in Perth. She featured the Premier, Walter James, as women's suffrage leading light. He lived near the Gibbs family in Perth. Walter James is regarded as the greatest social reformer in the history of Western Australia, With minimalist use of line, Blob depicts him as a visionary man with a very large brain. In 1899, Walter James succeeded in making Western Australia the second state in Australia to grant women the vote, ours being the first. As a young woman, May was well aware of suffrage issues. Miss Best, the principal of the school she attended for a term, was very active in suffrage circles. The St George Reading Circle, of which Miss Best was secretary, later became the Karakata Club, the first women's club in Australia. It focused on issues relevant to women, and May's mother was also a founding member, along with the governor's wife, Madeline Onslow, and Premier James's wife. Blob also earned money creating newspaper fashion advertisements. In 1902 and 1903, there are 18 of them. Cupid can be seen in the heading, and it's a theme she would repeat over the years as she responded to the topical issues of marriage and career. In 1904, May again set out for London. At Mr. Henry Blackburn's School for Black and White Artists in Westminster, she gained first-class results. And on return to Australia in 1905, she published under her own name. From then on, she wrote it in its characteristic circle. And here are some examples. Perth's annual RSPCA Fancy Dress Ball was held at Government House, and May's photograph by Henry Prinsep on the left is interesting, seen alongside her mirror image sketch of herself. May loved animals, was a founding member of the RSPCA, and was later awarded life membership. Many who went to the ball would have recognised themselves in May's sketches, for she always drew from life. The versatile May has fun here with her ability to caricature people, and you probably can't see the detail, but I do have one that you can look at over there. There's one that says, starchy, stiffy, sneery, sniffy, have a tiffy kind of hats. And in the next one, her mother is there on the right, in a hat of course, listening to woman suffrage campaigner and women's rights campaigner, Miss Ackermans. The next one is mother again. There she is. May always had her sketchbook with her. Dr. Alexander Hill visited Perth as a university extension lecturer in the early 1900s. Before Perth had a university. Hill was master of Downing College, Cambridge, and an advocate of classical education. He attracted capacity audiences who enjoyed witty anecdotes and poetry. And the next one is visiting Professor George Henderson of the History and English Department at Adelaide University, from 1902 to 1924, giving a university extension lecture in Perth. Henderson was a brilliant speaker, and over 1,000 people attended his lecture, his lectures on Hamlet. In Adelaide, his lectures were so popular that even when they were transferred from the university to the town hall, people had to be turned away. In Kalgoorlie, he was given a civic reception in appreciation of his lectures. He became known as the People's Professor. A copy of this newspaper hangs in the Henderson Room of the History Department at the University of Adelaide. I was thrilled to bits when it came out from behind a cupboard one day after I'd had a tutorial. Very exciting find. The discipline of history recently celebrated the the 110th anniversary of Henderson's appointment and featured one of May's caricatures from here in its publicity. In 1919, Henderson established Australia's first archives with one of his students, George Pitt, as the nation's first archivist. These are memory impressions of Professor Naylor, another lecturer in Perth and Kalgoorlie. Professor Darnley Naylor was described in the Western Mail as one of the most brilliant of the younger professors. He was founder and president of the South Australian Amateur Football League and the founding chairman of Scotch College. And I brought a photograph of him. May also did political cartoons. As you will notice, all this work is for adults. Here, May lampoons the West Australian Premier, Sir Newton James Moore, as a landlady, and I'm not sure why. Moore is greeting retired Admiral Sir Day Hortpesenke, South Australia's governor-elect, en route to his new post in the steamer seen on the horizon. A Marine follows him, carrying two damaged Navy warships in need of a dry dock. The sign shows that the nearest one is in Sydney. The campaign for a dry dock, which May supported in her caricature, did not succeed. Moore was educated at Prince Alfred College and was Premier of Western Australia from 1906 to 1910. The next one, between 1910 and 1911, Dr. William Lowry, MA, BSc, Edinburgh, was Director of Agriculture in Western Australia. He advocated a scientific approach to agriculture and was admired professionally for his high standards. Helped by his wit and practical ability, he developed good rapport with the farming community, seen here listening in attentively. May's cousin Winifred is the little girl. She was the daughter of her uncle George, lived at Harvey, shared May's fondness for animals and loved the stories May created for her. May's sketch here was in the Western Mail following the rescue of 32-year-old Modesto Varischetti on the 28th of March 1907. For 9 days and 2 hours, he'd been trapped 1,000 feet underground by sudden floodwaters at Bonnievale gold mine, 7 miles north of Kalgoorlie. News of the rescue was anxiously followed right round Australia, and May's imagined sketch was circulated as a postcard. In this one, the zoo notes, I'm reminded that May lived opposite the zoo. The dune was just the other side of the road, and the zoo was a source of inspiration for May. And human likenesses to animals was a recurring theme in her cartooning work. In the centre, the queer beast by Jove is her brother, Ivan, likened to a flamingo, particularly with regard to his nose. On this page, May also caricatured her parents. She likened her father to a noble lion, noting herself as his reason to be proud. I think he looks a bit like Bob Hawke. Her mother is caricatured this time not as a frog, but as a funny old bird. Apparently May's mother didn't mind a bit. May also did sporting caricatures, featuring Ivan, and these are the origin of sporting antics in Gumnut Town, and I've brought some of those. The next one is Ivan, the Wreck of the Hesperus, as a bridge player, and he's the one in the centre of the trio. The director, and the next one, director of the Perth Zoo, Colonel Le Sueff, is pictured in a cage with the animals outside looking in. May's tilt at what it's like to live in a cage. May was ever generous in giving artworks to her family and friends, and the Le Sueff family treasure this caricature of their forebear by a family friend who once lived near the zoo too. To give some idea of the Gibbs home, this unfinished painting of the drawing room at the Dune is painted by artist, silversmith and teacher J.W.R. Linton, whose silver you probably know. He was a South Perth family friend, a university extension lecturer and one of May's mentors. Through just a few of her caricatures, you can see the development in May's work. In 1907, she exhibited in the prestigious exhibition of women's work in Victoria. In 1909, she returned to England. At a rooming house in London, she became a great friend of socialist Rhene Heames, an active member of the non-militant National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies. The two attended meetings together, and May created caricatures and covers for the organisation's newspaper, The Common Cause. May had experienced the process involved in women getting the vote in WA. But in Britain, universal suffrage was not achieved until 1928. When Cicely Hamilton and G.K. Chesterton debated that the demand for the enfranchisement of women is a symptom of progress, tickets sold out days in advance. Positioned side by side, these caricatures capture the intensity of the debate. May would have identified with Hamilton's rhetorical question as to whether 20 years ago a woman could have stood up on a platform and boasted that she was well over 30 and unmarried. Chesterton was against the suffrage and was known for his rigid ideas. West Australian background on both sides of my family has proved fascinating for me. When May was contributing to the British suffrage cause through her caricatures, my suffragette aunt, great aunt, Kitty Broadhurst, was being subjected to force feeding in Holloway Jail. These young women knew about the challenges for women through their mothers, who'd moved in the same hen convention circles in Perth. Their circles contributed to the vote for West Australian women and to Edith Cowan's distinction as Australia's first woman Member of Parliament. In this caricature, you'll recognise William Winston Churchill in his 30s. At that time, he was British Home Secretary. He was anti-woman suffrage and had proposed a referendum to discover whether the majority of women wanted the vote. Grandpa A.H. on the left is Alfred Harmsworth, proprietor of the Times. Harmsworth deliberately set out to attract women readers. The Manchester Guardian claimed that Harmsworth made life more interesting for women. Gibbs caricatures him, warning Churchill against taking an initiative he might regret. Miss Referendum is depicted rolling her eyes and taking Churchill in both hands, and I think that's May. The figure appears in a lot of her work. May's books recall the suffrage years when the gumnut babies march in a campaign for more clothes. A similar figure, but younger than Miss Referendum, appears as the heroine Mamie in About Us, May's first book. I've got a postcard which you can look at, which is the cover from that. It was printed in 1912, after several of her books with an Australian theme had been rejected. And one of those I've got on a postcard too. It's a delightful picture of that same little girl bounding through the countryside in bare feet on a kangaroo's back. And in the one that she had to rework her story because the publishers in England wouldn't accept it, she's got the little same little girl in button-up boots and long stockings. Interesting comment on the more casual life we lead. At that time, May was also commissioned by publisher George Harrop as a book illustrator. She had so much work that she became ill from overwork, and early in 1913, she returned to Australia along with her friend Reen Heames. Following a short time when she was again published in Perth and encouraged by a Sydney friend, Wynne Preston, May left with Reen to seek the greater publishing opportunities open to artists in Sydney. They moved into a boarding house in Neutral Bay, and May rented the little studio at 4 Bridge Street in the city. She travelled there by ferry, as she'd done to reach Perth from South Perth. Ethel Turner, so well remembered for Seven Little Australians, published a serialised story, The Magic Button, in the children's page of the Sydney Mail, starting on December the 10th, 1913. The story was illustrated by May Gibbs, and as usual, she drew inspiration from her own life. The heroine Dot is similar to that little girl pictured with Churchill. But, as well as her drawings to illustrate the plot, May added a component which was not part of the plot. Peering out of the gumnuts in the title illustration, she drew faces. The first glimpses of her most famous creation, the gumnut babies. I've read the story right through, and it's not about gumnut babies. A few days before this page was published, May had registered gumnut baby creations for copyright. Within the next few years, these images would change the direction of her career. They'd become part of an Australian bush folklore she created for children. They would make hers a household name throughout Australia by the end of the First World War. Her work is described by the co-author, art historian Robert Holden, as the best known and most evocative Australian work after the Heidelberg School. May's model for the little boy in The Magic Button is surely her brother Bertie, who was also artistic and so much part of her childhood, but who died tragically at the age of only 18. On August the 4th, 1914, war was declared. May caricatured herself with her friend Reen a fortnight after the outbreak of World War I. Terrible thought. School spinster to art spinster. If the enemy came, they might seize us girls to be their wives. May annotated the copy she kept of this cartoon, the only drawing I ever made in the Bulletin. One of May's professional ambitions in Sydney was to succeed as a portrait artist. Here is a portrait of Reen, the English friend may caricature in the bulletin. It's a lovely example of her versatility. And who is this? May had many interesting women friends, and this is no doubt one of them. Another example of May's ability is the portrait of Bessie de Groot, whose husband, Captain F.E. de Groot, achieved notoriety when mounted on horseback, he slashed the official ribbon to open the Sydney Harbour Bridge, ahead of Premier of New South Wales, Mr. J.T. Lang, 80 years ago. There are more examples of May's portraits in the book, including fine watercolours of her parents, which you can see at Nutcote. In Sydney, May was commissioned to create 25 covers for the Sydney Mail. Due to the outbreak of war, only 8 of these were published. The dazzling woman with the orange hat or hair is probably one of May's magazine covers, which was never published because of the war. Years later, in an interview for the Sydney Morning Herald in 1953, she told the story. When World War I started, my job folded up, and I wondered just what I would do. Fortunately, someone asked me to make them a bookmark, and I designed one with a gum leaf and 2 funny little animals peeping over the top. Out of the 2 funny little animals were born the gumnut babies, and since then I have never looked back. It was Mrs. Zabel, a Perth friend of May's, who started the Roycroft Library in Sydney, who suggested the bookmark, and through her library she sold hand-painted copies for 5 shillings. They proved so popular that they were printed and sold for 6 pence in tens of thousands. The Sun, a Sunday newspaper, described May Gibbs in 1915 as a Sydney artist who specialises in painting Australian wildflowers and regrets the fast disappearance of the bush in close proximity to Sydney. A reminder that she was also a pioneer conservationist. This lone hand cover, depicting her creation of flannel flower babies, also demonstrates May's botanical accuracy. It typifies her resourcefulness in using her skills as a very fine painter of flowers. The Lone Hand magazine played a significant role in raising Australian cultural standards. All the work it published was commissioned, and it championed the artistic capacities of women. Its quality of reproduction was far superior to anything available to May in Perth, and there are examples which show this in the book. May contributed generously to the war effort, designing costumes for concerts and creating postcards. This wounded kookaburra, sitting with a wounded gumnut baby, is very endearing. May's postcard of Sister Susie sewing shirts for soldiers is also a delight, and there's a lovely 2-page spread of the original pen and ink illustration of it in the book. These postcards were sent to the diggers in Red Cross packages. May described her own birth as a delivery by Dr. Stork, a very European image. Here she depicts her brother Harold, the first surviving child of the family to be born in Australia, delivered by kookaburra. She was creatively and proudly Australian. She deserves to be as well recognised as Beatrix Potter, whose publishing success she would have been well aware of when she was in London in the early 1900s. And here is May, decked out in some of her creations and published in the Bulletin on Australia Day, 1916. On 5th of December 1916, with the release of Gumnut Babies, she realised her dream of creating a book inspired by the Australian bush. Published by Angus and Robertson, it sold out as soon as it reached the shops, and its sequel, Gumnut Babies, which cost more, sold out just as quickly. These books found their market without being promoted and attracted further offers from Mays Publishers. In November 1917, J.F. Archibald, editor of the Bulletin and a champion of Australian nationalism, applauded Mays' genuine contribution to our Australian folklore. Following her disappointment at having only ever had one of her cartoons published in the Bulletin, she must have felt rewarded. And this was a year before the printing of Snugglepot and Cuddle Pie in November 1918. May married James Asoli Kelly in 1919. She was the breadwinner, and on the strength of her earnings from Snugglepot and Cuddle Pie and the subsequent books, she had Nutcote built to suit her unique lifestyle in 1925 on land in Neutral Bay, which her mother had located. In a copy of one of the books she gave to her wonderful parents, she wrote, "To the blocks from their chip." That says it all. The way May utilised her talents makes her an outstanding woman. Her MBE in 1955 gave her great pleasure and was richly deserved. Her love for children is evident as far back as her first published work, Little Folks. Although her parents were a fine model for companionable marriage, her mother's life showed her that the career limitations of childbearing in those days before reliable birth control. Through her father's life, she saw how hard it was to make a living as an artist. Interestingly, Herbert Gibbs ceased to exhibit once his daughter's talent received acknowledgement and once she started winning prizes in Perth. Her parents had every reason to be proud, as she had noted in the Zoo Notes caricature. The inspiration for May's Gumnut Town can be seen in May's artistic, vibrant early life, and that is the subject of May Gibbs' More Than a Fairy Tale. Her artistic creations reflect her family life, her interesting friends, her love for the Australian bush, her love of children, even though she didn't have any of her own, her ability to make fun of things, her strong sense of justice, and her belief in herself as an artist. With her input from training and hard work, her life is much more than a fairy tale. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much, Jane. It was just a fantastic. I mean, so much of we probably know only an inch of what we learnt tonight about May Gibbs. A lot of us would have read her books, but we wouldn't have known the history and the background that we've got tonight. So it's wonderful that someone has taken the time and the effort. And Jane was telling us earlier that it was a big job. To write it down so that we all know. Some young people were helping me set up earlier today and they asked me who was the speaker tonight, and I told them. I said, but you may not know about it. It's about the lady who wrote Snugglepot and Cuddle Pie. Oh, they said, oh, we used to have those when we were young. And they were university students here now, fairly old. And so I just thought it was wonderful that her talent and her imagination is able to strike everybody. And people today are still looking at those books. But I think we have learnt, as Jane has tried to tell us, about this artistic life of this wonderful woman that we knew nothing about. So I'd like to thank Jane very, very much on our behalf for speaking tonight. I've jumped over because I'm sure somebody might have some questions. So has anybody got any questions before I sort of finalise what I'm saying to Jane? Any questions? I'm sure there must be some people who are dying to ask something.
Just a pity that Juliana Bayfield is not still with us.
Yes, I know what you mean. It's very sad. It would never, this book would never have happened without her. And she died only a few days after it was published. And I was able to give it to her.
It's really a comment rather than a question, but I didn't grow up with Snugglepot and Cuddle Pie, but I have a group of friends who are still terrified when they see a big bad Manxure man. So the big bad Manxure men were really characters that really gripped children.
Yes, they terrified me, absolutely terrified me. And when Juliana initiated this exhibition, she was very keen that members of the public contributed and said, do mention it to all your friends. My dear friend Cecily Hazy said to me, oh, well, you won't want my copy because I've crossed out all the Banksia men. Well, of course, that was perfect. That's exactly what we did want. We wanted all sorts of contributions that showed the influence of May Gibbs and the homework books and sketches and models and copies of the book coloured in over and over again came out. It was a wonderful exhibition. And I loved watching Japanese people peering into the cases and enjoying the detail so much.
Do you think part of it was the war years? That kind of, there's all sorts of things happening, like it's a little bit of fantasy when there's horrible stuff going on, but the big bad Banksia men can be the enemy, and, you know, all, like, the timing is extraordinary.
Yes, yes. I think she was very resourceful, and I agree. And she says that of the criticism of the Banksia men, that, you know, the fact is that there have to be, and there are, bad things as well as good.
How many years altogether are you working on?
Well, it's 25 years since I first supported the campaign to save Nutcote. And without that, it wouldn't, as with all sorts of other things, it wouldn't have happened. But we had a gathering to start the South Australian Action Group to support the saving of Nutcote in our garden when our son turned 21 and he's about to turn 44. So I never expected that it would have this hold on me. And as you say, as I've explained, I'm not related, I'm only connected. But she didn't have children and she has relatives. But so I've done my best.
Would you like to join again with me thanking Jane for coming on and telling us this wonderful story?